So in the last couple of days, Ariya and Sayadaw have spoken about the qualities of metta, the friendliness of metta. And I want to begin by reminding you of a verse that Ariya quoted the other day from the Dhammapada. Refrain from doing evil, cultivate the good, purify the heart. These are the teachings of all the Buddhas. This is the way of the awakened ones. Not feeding the unwholesome, cultivating the wholesome, purifying the mind and heart. And so we've come here to this retreat to fulfill these instructions that the Buddha offered to us. But sometimes the way to do that is not always so clear. So today, by way of encouragement, reassurance, I want to speak a bit about various challenging aspects of the metta practice, so that you better understand the process that just naturally unfolds as we develop metta. As Sayadaw said in his initial instruction now many days ago, metta bhavana can be done for the sake of developing concentration or for the sake of developing metta, or both. And concentration has its own rewards. It's like calm, peacefulness, quiet, a focused, one-pointed mind. And that's what we tend to think of as good practice. But by cultivating metta, the heart and mind can be purified as well. And this is an altogether different kettle of fish, so to speak. In the texts, there's a Pali phrase, metta chaito vimutti, the liberation of mind through loving kindness. And it appears over and over again in the primary texts. And this means, what this is meant by this is the release from suffering that's brought about by the practice and purification of metta and metta bhavana. And this transformation isn't magic. It's not like we wave a wand and it happens instantaneously. Yeah. Poof, all impurities instantly vanish. That would be nice. But it doesn't happen that way. So here you all are, you've made space in your lives, which is not easy. You've come all this way to practice, which is not easy. With the intention to open the heart, to develop kindness, love, it's very touching to read everybody's registration sheets. You know, why do you want to come? So there are these beautiful intentions. So you sit down and begin to practice, and all sorts of other things begin to arise that seem to, quote unquote, get in the way. Everything that isn't metta begins to arise. We get to see it. And the paradox of this practice that we've already referred to is that the difficulties that come up in the metta practice are the main doorway into the deepening of the metta, the deepening of compassion, the deepening of resilience of heart and mind. And it's a lawful and progressive process of purification. So if you're feeling vulnerable, challenged, please don't think you're the only one Hardly. Places of vulnerability and challenge in this practice are not places for doubt or confusion or even self-pity, but these are the places where resilience and that deeper metta does develop. So don't worry if you're feeling these things. Don't worry if difficulties come up. And don't worry if they come up again and again and again. It's not a one-time deal. All of you in your cleaning jobs, cleaning here in Myanmar, because it's dusty and there's stuff falling out of the sky every day, and we clean and it's pristine and beautiful, and the next day we come by and there are leaves all over the place and ashes on the floor and footprints in the hall, and you have to clean over and over and over again. This is patient, persistent work. And the other thing that you begin to notice, and it's fun because here, every year we do this metta retreat here, and every year this place begins to sparkle. It gets very clean. And then we all go away, come the rain, you know, the beginning of the rainy season, the, you know, New Year in early April, all the foreigners are gone. And it starts going back to its samsaric self. And we come back again in early January and start all over again. But as we clean, as we begin to clean, and this is when it begins to happen, actually. You've been cleaning for about a week, and you begin to see the places that you didn't notice before. Because at first, it was really grubby. So now that the surface dirt is gone, you begin to see what's there that's kind of in the corners and around different nooks and crannies and places where dirt has accumulated all year and had never gotten cleaned. And it's the same with the practice. At first, we purify superficial things, things that are easy to see. And the cleaner we get, the mind and heart, the more we see subtle things, things we hadn't noticed before because there were bigger things in the way. The Buddha had a simile for this. You know, you have a really grubby cloth, and you clean it. And you clean it, and you begin to see deeper levels of dirt that weren't clear before, were covered over with the overall grubbiness of the cloth. So in the same way, we start with the heart and mind, with its conditioning, with its habits, prone to all sorts of mischief. And gradually, patiently, we get it cleaner and cleaner and cleaner. So today, speaking about this purification, because it's a central aspect of the practice. And this is the very aspect of the metta practice that can have such a profound and lasting aspect on our lives and on our meditation practice. So at a superficial level, most of you are familiar with, in Pali, the word is nivarana. In English, we translate hindrances. Hindrances are fairly superficial. These come up in the practice, often near the beginning of the retreat. Greed, aversion, restlessness, sleepiness, doubt. These five hindrances and the various aspects of them. And at this point in the practice, especially near the beginning, when you were first here, this is when they naturally arise. Often it's our habit to succumb to discouragement, frustration, identification. Oh, I'll never get it, this practice. Everybody else is doing so well, and I'm the only one who's restless. I guess I just can't do this. Or, I you know, I can't do it right. Or maybe it's the other end of the spectrum. It's like, look at me, I'm sitting here so perfectly. If we succumb to these reactions and identification, we can really get spun out into all sorts of difficult mind states. But the fact that these hindrances are arising is not at all personal. It's a normal part of the practice. They arise in accord with conditions. You came from very busy lives. The world out there, quote unquote, as if it's different here, but the world that we, most of us, live in, the social world, is full of distractions. And in fact, distraction is the point of a lot of it. So we're deeply habituated to distraction, to greed, to not liking, to anger. We can't help it. We're marinating in that stuff. So these hindrances, they come up, it's normal. And we get to see that. Most talks about the hindrances, it's interesting. I've given many talks like this myself. Most people talk about the hindrances and go through each of them, saying, well, there's this hindrance, and it's like this, and this hindrance, it's like this, and this is what you do to make them go away. We call it, this is how you work with them, quote unquote. But often that boils down to, this is what you do to make them go away. The point in the metta practice is not to make them go away, because we can't make anything happen. The point is to care, as I said the other day. Can you care about your experience? Can you care about this aspect of being human and really hold it with kindness and friendliness, that beautiful friendliness that Ariya was talking about? Can you incline to the goodness that you see in yourself rather than obsessing about something that might be just a habit that's uncontrollable? Or are you totally sucked in and only see that challenge? Practicing with these states and purifying these states requires holding them like that. Not pushing them away, as we've said. Not making them a problem. Not trying to make them go away. One thing that's always helpful to remember in the practice, of course, life too, but particularly in the practice, when hindrances arise, of course they'll go away. They're conditioned phenomena. All conditioned phenomena arise and pass away. And you don't have to do that for them. So just letting them be what they are, putting them down, acknowledging them kindly, and really holding that whole thing with metta. So we purify by just letting things be and cultivating metta anyway, both at this superficial level of the hindrances and at much deeper levels. So this second aspect of purification that can happen as the metta practice deepens is that the practice itself begins to reveal those deeper levels of the psyche, those deeper layers of habitual reactivity, those deeper layers of conditioning. And these deeper layers of the mind are usually, we say in English, latent. They're hidden from us. And this word latent means they arise given conditions. They'll emerge to be seen. But normally they're not noticeable. So we go along thinking, oh yeah, well, you did nothing, I don't have that. And then the conditions arise to allow that to come up. and we're surprised. It's like, I had no idea this was here. So they're not normally expressed, these deeper layers, but arise when conditions are supportive of that. And each of us, every single one of us, has a unique mix of conditioned tendencies and habits. And these conditioned tendencies and habits can really stain the heart. It's like when you take something white and put it into, say, beet juice, you know, that deep magenta color that beetroot has, it stains that, whatever it is, food or fabric or what have you. It has an impression that doesn't wash out easily. So as the practice goes on, and now you're in the seventh full day of this retreat, and then slowly, slowly, as the heart begins to settle and quiet, and the metta and concentration begin to gain momentum, this is the time when it gets interesting, because this is the time that we begin to see these latent tendencies coming up. Because as the heart opens, as concentration deepens, the practice itself exposes, it's like it brushes away what was, you know, keeping us from seeing these things. In this context, it's worth mentioning, especially for people who have, you know, done a lot of meditation retreats. We see predictable patterns, both physical patterns of sensations that arise at different times of the retreat, as well as patterns of things emerging into the mind stream as we deepen into the practice. So if we've sat many retreats, sometimes it's very easy to say, oh, you know, take these things as little guideposts. Oh, yeah, this is a sign the concentration is deepening. And take them as landmarks. And sometimes these landmarks are really, really unpleasant. They're not welcome. Like unpleasant physical sensations, like tightness or vibration or uncontrollable movement, and strange perceptions of the body, strange experiences like this are very common as concentration deepens, and they can condition latent tendencies of reactivity. We don't like it. We get scared. So people can experience different things in reaction to these things, like confusion. What do I do? Am I doing it right or am I doing it wrong? You know. Or restlessness. You know, it's just too hard to be with. So we find ourselves kind of bouncing off the walls. Or doubt. Oh, maybe I shouldn't be doing this practice. Maybe this isn't safe. Or maybe they bring up strong emotions like fear, panic attacks, longing. So there are all sorts of things that bring out these latent tendencies in the practice, both the practice itself and, you know, whatever we might find ourselves thinking about our lives, or memories may come up. All sorts of things can happen. The other thing that we begin to notice in this time of the practice is the practice reveals to us the pervasiveness of certain mind states that we might not normally see so clearly or might not think are so important. Some of these latent tendencies, we may be vaguely aware that this happens to us, but we think, oh no, that's nothing. But what we begin to see when the metta and the concentration deepen is how actually they're what's driving the train. It could be anxiety, for example, or fear. And if we incline away from these things, thinking, oh no, it's just, this only arises sometimes, it's not important, that's missing an opportunity to deepen the metta, to deepen resilience, because that's denying that that's actually happening. And with a lot of these mind states that can arise as latent tendencies, the unwholesome ones, we can sort of know they're there, but not really want to know they're there. It's like, oh yeah, that's there, but not so important. We want to be good yogis, of course. And good yogis sit here peacefully, quietly, full of equanimity and metta. Oh yeah, that's there, but I'm doing really well with the metta. So be careful of that, because that can get you into trouble. And that's a missed opportunity. If something like this is arising, acknowledge it. Bring it into the light of metta. Hold it with metta. Really feel it. And cultivate compassion for this being who is sitting here practicing with that. This being who has a name and who has a history and who has a desire to wake up and is confronted with this first noble truth. Another thing to mention with regard to these latent tendencies in particular is when deeper conditioning begins to emerge into the mind stream. It's very common that people misinterpret whatever reactions are coming up to be about the situation here and now because of something or someone here. But often that's just, you know, there is this thing in the background that's not quite come into light. And the mind looks around and finds an excuse for that, when actually maybe it's something a lot deeper. So for example, maybe we're annoyed by the person in the other half of our kuti, and we're really angry about something they are doing or not doing. Maybe that's happening, but really, maybe what's happening is there's a habitual tendency for anger or dosa, and we're not really acknowledging that. Or maybe something here is causing us to feel a lot of fear, or we think it's something here, but really, there is this deep underlying tendency for fear that's beginning to come to the surface. And so we say, oh, it's about the dogs. Or it's about the fires, or it's about the food, or it's about other people, but really, that's only the story, the current story that this is telling us. So those of you who are feeling these things and who have really gently determined to stay with them, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. That's how you work with that. You don't try to change your room or fix the situation with the dogs or fix the situation with the food. You just be with it. And we're seeing a lot of this courage right now. It's very, very touching. you understand very clearly that if you were somewhere else, it would happen there too. Reactivity like this takes whatever is available as a trigger. So thank you for staying with it. It's very, very, it takes a lot of courage to do this and a lot of gentle determination. And a really discerning mind. Because it's really important when these stories come up to take them with a grain of salt, as we say in English. I don't know if that's an expression in German or Swiss German, but not to fully believe them. Not to fully believe those stories and to keep radiating the metta. Because very likely at this point in the practice, it's not your neighbor. It's not one of us, Ariya, Saito, or me. It's not the kitchen. It's not the rubbish. It's not the air. This is just latent tendencies expressing themselves based in current conditions. So rather than trying to fix external conditions, the practice at this point asks us to just be with it. Just keep doing the metta practice, kindly, as we have already described at length, and just let it all unwind. And we know very well that this can be disconcerting or surprising. But please don't worry. Just as with the more superficial levels of hindrances, it's natural that this happen. It's natural and necessary that we see these things, acknowledge them, work with them. This process is completely normal. I can't tell you how many times people have asked us, is it all right that this, is this normal? Various different storylines around that question. But is this, am I doing it right? This is completely normal when these things happen, when these things emerge. This is quote unquote lawful, as in accord with Dhamma. You aren't doing anything wrong. In fact, when people uncover memories, tendencies, habit patterns, especially the kind that they'd never seen before, I find myself going, oh boy. I try not to do that so obviously, because when you're in the middle of this, it's really, really not a joyful thing. But I'm sitting there thinking, oh good, good. Good practice. It means you've come up against a new internal edge that you hadn't been aware of before. This is arising. And all you need to do is to keep going. So with superficial hindrances, with deeper tendencies, deeper levels of conditioning, the purification of metta bhavana, because we work with these categories, deepens in a fairly predictable and sequential way as we open the heart gradually to beings in these different categories. One of the beauties of this form is its simplicity and its gradual widening of the heart's scope to eventually encompass all beings everywhere without exception. And we start where it's relatively easy or easiest and go from there. So as we've described, as Saito's described in more detail, we use these different categories of people as objects of our metta practice. To gradually broaden and strengthen the heart's capacity to develop metta. To open in the face of challenge. Where the metta is most accessible, because we directly experience it, is of course with ourselves. That's why we start there. For those of us conditioned in the West, it may not be the easiest category, but it's directly known, this desire to be well, to be happy, to be peaceful. We know this for ourselves. I want to be happy. That's why we're here. That's why we practice. We want to be free from suffering. So we directly know it. And then with another being who is a benefactor, this first category of others is there because there's not so much in the way. Traditionally, this is described as the respected person, a teacher, somebody we're not very close to. We might not even know them at all, but we easily see their goodness and we feel grateful for them in our lives. This category is not so complicated because there isn't this closeness. Once the practice begins to expand to dear people, friends, family members, then it can get more complicated because we know these people better. We've interacted with them. We rub up against them. We may love them, but then also there's other stuff in there. Like attachment, like bad memories. So all sorts of things can complicate our relationship with this person. So the metta is not flowing so easily. Sayadaw has led you into deepening the metta practice this year. By introducing parents as respected people, family members as respected people. It's kind of a fusion between the respected person and the dear friend. And it's true that sometimes these two categories are hard to tease apart. People we respect, people we really are appreciative of in our lives are often family members, people we're close to. So how he's led you in to the metta by first introducing the respected people and then introducing family members as respected people acknowledges this. So with particularly the dear friend, this category you've been working with now, it's the place where we begin to see emotional attachment quite strongly. And emotional attachment, what's in the texts called sentimental attachment, is what's called the near enemy of metta. Near enemy because, it's not metta. The near enemy because it's easily confused with metta. So, I love this person so much. That's not metta, that's attachment. As we've said repeatedly, metta is not involved. Metta has no agenda and no preference. It's just well-wishing. So, when we work with this dear friend category, this kind of clinging attachment is what gets purified as we go through this category, primarily. And then as we deepen, we progress to the category of what's called the neither loved nor hated person. Often in the West, we call this the neutral person, which is it's misleading because there's no such thing as real neutrality. And as soon as we begin to radiate metta for these people, we find they're becoming dear friends. But neither loved nor hated is what's said, particularly in the Burmese. That really captures it. These people are the people we don't really notice because we're not pulled towards them. We're not reacting against them. I like thinking of this category as the invisible people, the people we don't even notice because, you know, they're kind of beige. You know, we don't pay any attention to them. And so when we progress to this category of the neither loved nor hated person, we begin to purify delusion, that form of delusion that just doesn't see people. And it can be humbling, a little shocking, to see how many people in the world fit this kind of category. Intellectually, we know this because there are close to 8 billion people here on this planet, and we only know a handful. So, you know, you can read the headlines and read horrible things that are happening somewhere else and not really react very much because, well, you don't know these people. But if you knew them, you'd be going, you know, there'd be a strong response. And we all, for ourselves, most of us anyway, know the pain of being invisible. So this is part of the shock of this category. It's like, oh my word, being invisible is so uncomfortable, and I'm just rendering most of humanity like that. And so when we get that, when we really have that experience of, oh my goodness, this really begins to open the heart to beings we do not know and cannot know. Because we don't like, just as I don't want to be invisible, I don't want to be not seen. So does everybody. You know, we want to be valued. We want people to connect with us. Not just kind of go, oh, you know. So this really begins to open the heart and purifies that delusion that is just non-awareness. And of course, after this neither loved nor hated person, we take the exponential leap of difficulty and we go to the disliked person, or the enemy, as it says in the texts. Enemy is a very strong word. And this category actually has two aspects. There are people that are difficult because we just don't like them. And this is where we have a response to them that's just kind of, ugh. It has nothing to do with them. We just have that dislike. Maybe their socks, we don't like the color of their socks, or the way they walk, or the sound they make when they eat. These sorts of responses are very common in retreat. And, you know, in a big Vipassana retreat, Vipassana vendettas can be quite entertaining to watch from the outside. You know, somebody likes the windows open, somebody likes them closed, and you get these little wars going on, and people have these kind of mutual hatred attacks. So there is that category of the enemy that comes when we just decide we don't, for some arbitrary reason, we don't like that person. Yeah, you know, like their haircut, or they don't have tattoos, or whatever it is. None of it's important. We just have this arbitrary, not because of anything they've done. Usually it's quite trivial. And this is a good place to start this category. Nobody's done anything to you. This is not somebody who's harmed you in any way or acted in a way that's hurt you. This is just somebody doing what they do and, you know, they're just being themselves and you don't like it. Then, as you deepen with this category of the enemy, comes the much harder place of purification. Once you can radiate metta to somebody you don't like, then taking the deeper step to radiating metta to somebody who's actually harmed you. We've all, each one of us, has hurt somebody in this life. And each one of us has been hurt. And this is a good entry to this place of purification. Acknowledging that we're not pure as the driven snow. It's not like we've never hurt somebody before. So when other people hurt or harm us, intentionally or unintentionally, finding the space to begin to radiate metta to them, it can be very challenging. But acknowledging, oh, okay, I've made mistakes too, and they're just being human. Connecting with the common humanity of this person, just as we connected with the common humanity of the neutral person, the neither loved nor hated person. So working with this category reveals and forces us to deal with many levels of reactivity, both superficial and latent. And it requires a much more continuity and strength of metta than the other categories, which is why we often say to people, people sometimes come on retreat and they really want to work with that problem person in their life. Whether it be a family member or an ex-spouse or somebody who's betrayed them. And you really have to hold the reins in. It's like, no, don't go there yet. Please don't go there yet. You know, this category requires a strength of heart, requires a resilience that comes from the purification in the previous categories. Because a whole constellation of unwholesome mind states can arise in this, around the people in this category. The stories of our lives around people who have walked all over us to get the job we wanted, or who betrayed us, or who may have actually physically harmed us. From simple rage to much more complicated emotions like jealousy, envy, spite, vindictiveness, you know, that beautiful German word, Schadenfreude, you know, how we really want something bad to happen to them and how delicious that will be. You know, it's really yucky, but it can come up in this category. And the difficult people and our responses to them usually involve the core issues of our lives. This is where those latent tendencies really come to be seen. And really, it forces us to work with them. So it's both a challenge, this category, and a window into what hooks our ego tendencies. To practice successfully with this category of the enemy requires particular vigilance about not following the stories we tell about them and us. It's also the category where really large shifts can happen, where a lot of purification can happen. And then once we're successful with developing true metta for the enemy, then we kind of graduate to all beings, where the heart widens as far as possible. You've already been radiating metta for all beings in a more general way. Radiating metta to all beings after going through all of these categories has a different flavor than that. We see the beginnings of it as you walk the forest path and the heart opens. But as the purification process moves on, the depth and strength of the metta for all beings really does have a more profound flavor. And with all beings, the purification that's already happened in these previous categories, this is where that begins to be consolidated, broadened, established, and strengthened. So as this purification process unfolds, as we deal with all our reactivity that each of these categories elicits, what begins to happen is that the experience of metta, the well-wishing itself, becomes even. We really do see the impartiality of it, this beautiful equality that we've all talked about it to a certain extent. So that the metta we feel for ourselves, the well-wishing we have for ourselves, is no different than the well-wishing for our enemy or for all beings. Just like that. Even, the same, no difference. In the texts, what is offered as a description of this is a metaphor for meeting bandits at a crossroads. And they come up to you and say, well, we need one of your party for a blood sacrifice. The texts are very kind of brutal sometimes. And you're walking on a journey with, you know, you're not alone. You're with your dear friend, your benefactor, your nurturing person, your enemy. And you're all walking along on a long journey, and these bandits come. And they ask you to choose. You choose. We need one of you. So do you choose your enemy? It's like, ha, ha, ha. Oh, good. They're gone. Do you choose yourself? Kind of. Oh, I'll do it for everybody else. When you can't choose, when you say, well, sorry, all the same, that's a sign that the metta has been most deeply and profoundly established. And that's a sign that this purification is deeply and profoundly established. So the purification of metta bhavana, first at the level of hindrances, and then with these latent tendencies, and as a sequential revelation of how we react to others in our lives. As you all know very well by now, it's not an easy process. And here, the attitude we bring to the practice is so, so important. Because when faced with hindrances, latent tendencies, unpleasant experiences, it's important, again, to remember not in any way to push them away, to remember you're doing this practice in order to care, not in order that they go away. And so to have that real, almost tangible attitude of acceptance is really important. You're not here to get through them. You're not here to change yourself in any way. We're just here to cultivate metta, and it's metta's job to bring this evenness of mind. We can't do the work of metta for it. We just need to create the conditions for that to arise and for metta to do what it does, which is to care without exception. That inherent function of metta, which is the friendliness that Ariya was talking about, to be the antidote to any form of ill will or aversion or fear. So in cultivating metta, it's not about, again, forcibly pushing away or suppressing these unwholesome mind states. I can't say this enough, because it's really hard to remember this. We're cultivating friendliness. It's so easy to forget that. And if we can't be friendly towards whatever is arising in our immediate experience, it's going to be hard to be friendly to anyone else outside. And this can be tricky because we do tend to follow thoughts about anxiety or anger or fear. Or at the very least, we do try to figure out, what's this about? Why is this happening? And of course, and it's not a bad thing to want to practice correctly with them. But what's so easy to forget is the almost childlike simplicity of this practice. All you need to do is acknowledge, feel, not go into the middle of whatever it is, but surround it with this field of metta and keep cultivating loving kindness however you can. The practice has its own natural pace, and that pace varies from person to person. So please don't expect yourself to follow a schedule. Oh, it's day 7, I should be able to do this. No, maybe. Maybe you did that on day 1. Maybe you'll do that on year 7. You know, there's no way of knowing. So please don't try to live up to some arbitrary standard of perfection. Ideals are wonderful, but they're just ideas. And we have this ideal of a yogi who can do this, but that's just a concept. The reality of experience in the present moment is what it is. That's what we practice with, moment to moment to moment. And it's impossible to take that and turn it into something else by an act of will or force. And you can't turn it into metta by that will or force either. So like training a really good dog, a puppy, you don't beat them up. You use one of those, you know, when you're training a dog, oh, good dog. You use this really stupid high voice. Oh, good dog. Good sit. You know, think of that, directing that voice to yourself. Because that's the lightness you need. That creates a safe space. We create a safe space inside. It's not about the external things, again. So give yourself a safe space to allow, where the mind can be pliable and willing, a willing worker. And trust the process. I mean, it's easy for me to say this, but it does work. But based on what's happening, that's not always obvious when we're in the middle of it. So it's easy to think, oh, nothing's happening. This is useful, or useless, I mean. Or, oh, something's happening, and this isn't metta. Maybe this is the wrong practice for me. I must not be doing this right. While it's really easy to think these things when the practice is actually going along quite lawfully and quite well, this is where that grain of salt is really necessary. There's nothing you need to fix or change. That will happen by itself. The metta will take care of that. And samsara will take care of that, because all conditioned things change again. We just have to surrender to the fact that challenges have arisen and to gently keep doing the practice. Patiently, persistently, even if it feels mechanical, even if it feels like, you know, well, this isn't metta. And to connect as much as you can with the well-wishing, with the phrase, with the meaning of it. The most difficult practice is where it can be the most fruitful. That's also a good thing to remember. So This is where, when we rest against these edges, but not push against them, where we surrender, there it is, now what? Well, may I be well, happy, and peaceful anyway. This is where we gain that resilience of heart. So at times like those, you just need to embrace what's happening. Embrace whatever is coming up with that metta mindfulness and include whatever it is in that field of metta, that just hold it. And in this way, we train, develop, and purify the mind through all these categories. So we're all these unique bundles of causes and conditions. Everybody has something. Some of us come to the metta practice more on the craving side of the spectrum. Some people come to the metta practice more on the pushing away side of the spectrum, the dosa side of the spectrum. Others may be more kind of space shuttles, more diluted. This is human nature. We're all something like this, a mix. Each of us has our particular challenges. For those of us on the dosa side of the spectrum, maybe it takes more time to cultivate metta because we just, our tendency is to strike out. But there's great comfort to be had in the fact that metta is the natural antidote to dosa, to ill will, to fear, and to many other difficult, unwholesome mind states. The practice gives us a means to work with that. But it isn't anesthesia or suppression. It's quite the opposite. We dive in to feel what's there, no matter what, and keep radiating the metta. So, yes, it's not always easy. Yes, the practice and the process asks for humility, patience, deep honesty. But it works for everybody. Regardless of who you are, of what perceived limitations you have, of what habits and conditioning you bring to the practice. I want to end the talk today with a poem that I like very, very much. It's by a famous Japanese poet from the 10th century, Izumi Shikubu. And she was a courtesan and a mystic and a wonderful poet. And I want to preface this with a little explanation, because when I first read this, there's a theme, a trope, that runs through a lot of Zen poetry about the full moon being a metaphor for awakening. So when I read this poem for years and years and years, I thought, oh, full awakening. But then I really read the poem and I understood, oh no, just the opposite. Because she's not talking about the full moon, she's talking about the half moon, being half cooked. Not completely deluded, but not completely awake. So, it's a very short poem. Watching the moon at dawn, solitary mid-sky, I knew myself completely. no part left out. I'll read it again, because just imagine a half moon straight overhead. This is us. We're here on retreat, so we're not completely deluded. But we're not Buddhas yet either. We're kind of halfway in between. Watching the moon at dawn, solitary, mid-sky. I knew myself completely. No part left out. So through this gradual purification, may we all know ourselves completely with that beautiful metta that sees and accepts and leaves nothing out. Thank you for your practice, everybody, and thank you for your kind attention.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.